Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 25th of January 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Yes, we're racing into 2021. The days are getting longer. It's getting sunnier in the mornings. There's glorious snow out there this morning, and what better way to spend the Sunday afternoon than talking to my co-host here, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. It's beautiful seeing the snow outside. Is it snowing where you are?
It isn't actually snowing, but it has snowed. It snowed yesterday, and it snowed yesterday evening. And I went out for a walk to the local shops in the snow, and I really do like the snow. Actually, I've always liked the snow. I like walking in the snow. I like driving in the snow, and so I just love it. Actually, it's if all the winter was snow, then that would be great, and we missed out the slush bit at the end, and we missed out like the wet weather at the beginning of the winter. So if we had summers that were nice and dry and sunny, but then just overnight it flicked to wintry with snow on the ground, that would be wonderful, because then it would be like Christmas for 6 months of the year and then summer holiday for the other 6 months of the year. So yeah, I'm feeling in a light-hearted mood, I suppose.
What I really like is when the sun comes through the curtains and it's got a different feel to it, where it's reflecting off the snow. It's a really bright light, and you get up and you just know that it's snowed outside and everybody's really cheerful. And of course, we do need something to pick up our spirits, because we keep being told that this lockdown just gets longer and longer and longer. I was expecting it to be lifting in March. Boris Johnson said that he was hoping to get it finished in March in time for Easter. Now he's talking about it going on into April. You were just telling me before we began the show that apparently the business has been told they've got to close until July. Of course, this is the problem with this. It's a natural threat to us. The virus is a natural threat to us, and we have to live with it, basically. We can't. We're not going to be able to eradicate it. We have to find ways to live with it. We can't just put life on hold until everybody is immune to it, because that is just not going to happen. They've got problems with the vaccines now. It's come out of Israel that the Pfizer vaccine is only 25% effective after one dose. We've got the doctors over here in Britain now saying that rather than waiting 12 weeks till the second dose, they need to be waiting 6 weeks. So the vaccine schedule is all being messed up. We've had lots of people that have died in care homes because they thought that they were immune, or at least had 60, 70, 80% immunity after that first jab. And there's very little immunity whatsoever that's caused by this first jab. And now we're hearing today from Jonathan Van Tam that after two doses of the vaccine, you may still be infectious. You may still be infecting people. I mean, it just goes from bad to worse. You know, as you pointed out right at the beginning of all of this, back in last March, Max, what they should have done is just protected the people that were vulnerable to this, got them to stay in at home, made arrangements to deliver them food. And everybody that wasn't susceptible to this, they could have gone on and carried on with their work. They're trying to terrify, I think, people that are under the age of 50 now. They're saying that half the beds are filled with people under the age of 50. But I doubt whether that's people that are on ventilators or anything like that. That's people that have come down with this, and they will defeat this. They will get better again afterwards. The actual numbers of dead that we have had really isn't that much statistically different than any other year. The whole way that they have dealt with this has been suspect from the start, and I really think what it's all coming down to is this universal basic income that they're going to come out with at the end of it. They're going to tell everybody that they're all going to be on a wage from the government, and we're going to have to hire things, and nobody's going to be able to own anything, and they're going to have complete control over everyone, over their bank accounts. It will be the government that is paying us the money, and they'll be able to withdraw that at any time if people are critical of the government. I think that's the way that it's going. I mean, I just don't see any light at the end of the tunnel now that I mean, maybe I've been foolish because I've been saying, well, it looks like it's going to be lifted in November. It looks like it's going to be lifted in January. Looks like it's going to be lifted in March. And every time they just extend it and they keep this lockdown going on for longer. What are your thoughts on this, Max? Can you think of anything positive that we could look forward to?
Oh, crikey, now you're asking for something positive to come out of it.
Snow, more snow.
Well, we've got some snow, that's right. I think everybody's got plenty of time to exercise. And so, because cinemas aren't open and theatres aren't open. And so what I would say to people is to stay fit, because one of the problems with being in lockdown is that you may not have things to occupy your mind. If you're somebody that's been furloughed and all of a sudden you've got all the time in the world, but nothing's open and you're not allowed to do anything. And so the problem that people are going to face is boredom, and which means that people will be sitting around. It's been revealed that we in Britain are now drinking far more than we did in the past, and I think this is because people are frustrated, and so they go and buy some beer or they go and buy some spirits or wine and have a drink in order to help themselves relax. And the danger is that we'll become kind of couch potatoes, watching Netflix, drinking and stuffing ourselves with crisps in order to satisfy our frustration. So the thing to do is to remain fit. That's the primary thing, and not just fit in terms of your body, but fit in terms of your mind. So what I would say to people is to find something new to occupy your mind and to stretch your mind. Buy yourself a musical instrument. Take up playing chess, take up doing puzzles, take up reading, because very often nowadays we're too lazy to read, and we will just sit in front of the television and have images telling us the story instead of us having to read the story. But reading is a far more active thing for your mind, because you've got your eyes are having to focus on the words and interpret those words into sentences that are then meaning for you, and you have to think about it. And in terms of the way in which scenes are described in books, instead of you just seeing a scene shown to you on a TV screen, you read the words and you imagine the screen. And so it's actually giving your brain more exercise than just watching TV would do. So find things to occupy your mind, but also find things to keep you fit and to keep you active. If you've got the ability to go for walks, then go for walks. If you've got a bike, go out and go on a bike ride. If you've got any other way of taking exercise, then make sure you take regular exercise, and also make sure that you eat well as well in order to keep your body fit and your mind fit. Because whatever happens, the fitter you are, the more mentally agile you are, then the better off you're going to be in order to be able to cope with the things that happen. I can recall an old boss of mine who once, well, he didn't say it once, he said it quite a few times because he was apt to repeat himself, but he said that most people say that death and taxes are the only certainties in life, but in fact there is a third certainty, and that third certainty is that as time goes by, life becomes more complicated, and the speed with which it increases in complexity accelerates all the time. And so what we've got to be able to do is to adapt to the changes that face us. And at the moment, one of the biggest challenge to us is that we're all living to some extent in a state of suspended animation. Now, why governments would choose to use a virus which appears to be somewhat more severe for the people that it creates complications for than the flu or the common cold, but only somewhat more severe. It's not, we're not facing the Black Death or anything of that sort. We're not going out in the day and finding corpses laying at the side of the road where people have expired or anything of that sort. There is a virus, but it isn't a plague like the Black Death was. And so for the government to make the overreaction that they have done just seems strange. And for the government to put our entire society in a state of suspended animation, and for other countries around the world to do similar things as well, all at the same time, just seems to me to be absolutely bizarre. And it's at the moment that there isn't any information that we can rely upon that will explain what's why the government have, well, not the, just our government, but why governments have taken the steps that they have. And so as far as we, the common people, are concerned, it is a bit of a mystery. And we can only wait to see what the eventual outcome of all this is. That there are the conspiracy stories that are going around, some of which, there's a fair bit of credibility to some of them. Some of them, but, none of them can be proven as for sure. And so these things get talked about. And one thing that made me laugh last week was the publication of information that amongst black and minority ethnic communities in Britain, there's a far higher proportion of people saying that they won't take the coronavirus because they don't trust the government. The government isn't, that the government isn't composed of people who look like them, and so they don't trust the government. Well, I can assure that people from the black and ethnic minority communities in Britain, there's lots of white people that don't trust the government either, and I don't trust the government. And I will think long and hard when the letter arrives from my GP telling me that he's got my COVID vaccine ready for me to go and be injected. I have to say that, if I'm absolutely honest, I don't know what I'm going to do there. I certainly won't take it if it's the Pfizer vaccine, because the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines involve a radical new technology, which I don't think has been tested properly and long enough. And I know that there are lots of people who work within the National Health Service who quietly aren't going to take the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccines either. And so we're left with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which appears to have been created using traditional vaccine creating methods. And so therefore I've got trust in that. But even so, I'm still undecided. I may just refuse to take the vaccine on the basis that I have never taken a flu vaccine in my life, and I can remember very vaguely catching the flu when I was about 16, because there was a flu pandemic then, which was just like 2 weeks of a very snotty nose and headaches, aching bones. But other than that, I don't think I've had the flu ever as an adult, and I don't see why that should change.
I think the AstraZeneca vaccine, I think that was the one, or that's to do with Oxford, and they were working alongside Russia as well. And it seems to me the Russia vaccine, the Sputnik V, that would seem to be the preferable vaccine to take. That was made with traditional ways, tried and tested ways, and it's also a fraction of the price that the Pfizer vaccine is. I don't understand why there's been this huge rush to use this Pfizer vaccine, to be honest. The Sputnik V, that was available for sale months ago, and they've been vaccinating people in Russia for a long time now. And in actual fact, that was the first vaccine that was available. And if they were really concerned about getting everybody back on their feet again and getting everybody vaccinated as fast as possible, they would have used that one. Why did they wait until now to use this experimental Pfizer vaccine? Why is that the one that's been given out in Britain instead of the Sputnik V? And this is another question here. You really have to ask yourself, what is going on here? I think the main conspiracy theory that I think is possible is that the economy was going to crash and they needed an excuse. They needed something else that they could blame for the economy crashing, because that's eventually what happens with usury. When you have usury in the system, the debt just keeps building up because there isn't enough currency in circulation to pay back that debt, because there is interest put on every loan, so there is never enough to actually pay it back. And eventually, over the years, it builds up and it builds up and it builds up, and we get more and more inflation. And they need to reset the system. And this virus is the perfect excuse, because they can say, well, it was because of the virus we had to get everybody to stay at home, and that crashed the economy, so it's the virus's fault, rather than accepting that actually it was the fault of usury. It was the fault of greed. It was the fault of us going back on our traditions. I mean, it was one of the oldest European traditions, was that we never didn't have usury. It's written about the Germanic tribes that they usury was completely alien to them, and then right the way up to the time of Alfred the Great, we didn't have usury, and then it sort of came in with the Bank of England, and ever since then we've had these problems, and the debt that just builds up, and the banks end up purchasing everything. So I think that is likely the likely going to be the reason for it. We've had some interesting news last week. 400 Orthodox Jews were discovered within a school holding an illicit wedding, and they've been fined. And this has made the news because we've had similar things happening in New York. There were Orthodox Jews there that were ignoring the coronavirus lockdown, and there's been quite a few of these Orthodox Jews that have been interviewed about this, making their excuses for it. But it does look like they seem to think that they're above the law in some way. And of course, when they get caught doing this, they make the accusations of anti-Semitism. That's what they did against the governor of New York. They called him an anti-Semite for pointing out that it was Jews holding funerals and Jews holding weddings that were the main people that were actually breaking these coronavirus regulations. The other people that are breaking the regulations, of course, have been the ethnic minorities, and we find that they are the ones who are most likely to actually suffer from this virus. And there is a theory that it's due to lack of vitamin D. Because of the melanin that they have in their skin, they're not able to absorb the vitamin D from the sunlight to such a degree that we are as white people. And since they're in white countries, they should be topping up with vitamin D. And of course, they don't. And that weakens their immune system. So we had this report into why ethnic minorities are susceptible to the virus. And of course, they blamed white people. They said systemic racism because we didn't give them good enough jobs. They don't have enough jobs. They can't afford big enough houses. They all have to live together. It's all the white man's fault. So now we come out with the vaccine. And we have Sadiq Khan saying, well, it should be the ethnic minorities that are given this vaccine first. And then, as you pointed out, Max, they're all saying, well, we don't trust you to give us this vaccine. We're not going to take the vaccine. So what is it they want? You know, we've discovered the reason for why it is that they're more susceptible to this. We've got a solution for them. And now they're refusing to accept the solution. And they're saying the reason why they are refusing to accept it is because of institutional racism. The same thing that they blamed for why they were susceptible to getting the virus in the first place. It really does seem that you just can't please these people. We've also now been told that there are more variants of the virus, and this becomes a big excuse for why we need to have extra lockdowns and why we can't trust the vaccine, because the virus keeps mutating. All viruses mutate. You were telling me before we went on air, Max, that there's a Brazilian version, a South African version, Kent version.
There are nine variants now of the coronavirus spreading around the world. There was the original variant, then there was the British Kent variant, which took over from that. Then there's been a South African variant, a Nigerian variant, a Brazilian variant, two different variants found in Ohio, that takes up to seven. Different variant again found in Texas in the United States, that's eight. And then there is a split off from the Brazilian one, which is unique to Japan, which is called the Brazilian stroke Japanese variant. And so this is one of the reasons why, you know, what the governments are doing at the moment is unsustainable. And the reason why it's unsustainable is that in all probability, before we have all been inoculated with the vaccine for the original coronavirus, then there will be a variant that will evolve, that will mutate, that will be resistant to the vaccine, and so then they have to find another vaccine, and then they'll have to find another vaccine, and it will become exactly the same as it is now with the flu, where virtually every year the government and the health authorities will have a guess at which strains of the coronavirus will be spreading around Britain. So they'll produce a vaccine for it and then have everybody go in and get vaccinated again, or as many people as they can persuade to go in and get vaccinated again. And the virus will just keep swirling around the world and mutating all the time. And this is why, in my view, the original solution I proposed, which is that those people who are younger and healthier and for whom these viruses pose a much smaller problem should be allowed to carry on working, because by working, we will come into contact with small amounts of the virus, that there'll be small, we will perhaps encounter a small dose of the viral organisms, and because we've only been affected by a small dose, it means that our immune system will have the maximum chance of being able to combat it and overcome it and produce antibodies so that we're protected against that virus in the future. And it is only by exposing ourselves to small amounts of any kind of contaminant or any kind of bacteria or virus that we build up a natural resistance to these things. And I think that by having lockdowns where people don't go to work and people wear masks and hide away in their homes instead of going out and enjoying life as they should be, by doing that, what we're doing is we're denying ourselves any chance of our bodies building up natural immunity to the viruses that are swirling around. And if we'd been allowed to continue working the way that we had, then there would be a very large proportion of the working population, people of working age, would have already developed some resistance to these coronaviruses. And as each year went by, portion of people with the resistance to the coronavirus would have grown and grown, and within probably 5 years the coronavirus would either be regarded in much the same way that different strains of flu are regarded today, or it would be regarded it may even have been driven into extinction, so it would be a far less significant thing. But we're making it a big thing, and by making it a big thing, it's becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's becoming a big thing.
Yeah, I think that's the reason why they never came out with a vaccine for the common cold, because it's continually evolving and continually changing. So as soon as they actually came out with a vaccine for it, the form of the common cold would be different to the one that the vaccine inoculated you against. And it does look as if it's the same thing that's happening now with these new variants, as they call them, of the coronavirus. I don't know why they make such a big thing about it, because we've known that it's been evolving ever since we first heard about it. You could really excuse them at first, you know, being very concerned about this, because we were seeing videos of people dropping down dead in China. Lots of videos like that and terrible things happening. And then but then China said, well, we've got rid of it now. Nobody needs to wear masks anymore. Let's all get back to work. And apparently they just stopped testing, and they've been having huge pool parties and all the rest of it. And China's economy has got back on track. And of course, China's economy is separate to the West and the Western economies, and all the Western economies are still shut down. So this is the reason why there are all these attacks on China that are in the news. They're constantly trying to find some kind of excuse to go after China, talking about their mistreatment of the Uyghurs being forced to pick cotton, or mistreatment of Muslims or what have you. And it's all a distraction. The reason for it is because China didn't do this lockdown, and China's economy is booming, and the World Banks want everybody's economy to be locked down, as Lukashenko pointed out from Belarus, that he was offered this huge loan, and what he had to do was lock his country down and force everybody to wear masks, because these masks are pointless. All you have to do is have an electric cigarette and have a blast on that, put your mask on, blow the vapor out, and everybody can see the vapor. It's a talisman. That's all these masks are. Unless you're actually going to wear a proper FFP3 mask, which are banned from sale to the public, then you're not actually going to be protected from this. I can't see a way out anytime soon, and we have to talk about it really, because that's all that's going on. There's nothing else going on in the news. I did find one news article last week that I thought was relevant, and this is pretty good, and this is actually about Jacob Rees-Mogg. Jacob Rees-Mogg has thanked the Woke Brigade for reminding Britons of the great heroes in the country's history. The Commons leader said he believes people are now more aware of the statues they walk past and want to learn about them. Responding to a request for a debate on protecting Britain's history and heritage, Mr. Rees-Mogg told the Commons, "In a funny way, the Woke Brigade has done the nation a service because they've reminded people of the great heroes that we have. Lots of statues that people used to walk past and not really notice. They suddenly think, gosh, that's Gordon of Khartoum. He's an interesting figure. I want to know more about him and what he did to put down the slave trade in the Sudan. I think this has helped remind people of our history and that it is a history we can be enormously proud of. That British people did great things in this country and across the globe. And we see that actually in the United States. The United States, when it sought its freedom, wanted to ensure that it had the freedoms that the people of the United Kingdom were entitled to at home. It was a most fantastic history that we should be proud of and celebrate in our statues and in our education. So we should be grateful that the wokery classes have had this effect on improving our understanding of our noble history." And we preempted this. We really did preempt this at Radio Album. We started doing our Greatest Britain series about September, October in 2019. And it wasn't until last summer that the iconoclasm really began with the destruction of the statues. And of course, we talked about Gordon of Khartoum. He was one of our Greatest Britons. So I do find it encouraging that Jacob Rees-Mogg also looks up to Gordon of Khartoum and sees him as a great British hero. And he's saying here that, you know, it is encouraging people to look into our past and learn more about our great heroes. And I wonder whether Jacob Rees-Mogg has been listening to Radio Albion, because it is exactly what we have been saying. So it's good to know that there are still some politicians that agree with us. Well, what do you make of Jacob Rees-Mogg's little speech here in the Houses of Parliament, Max?
Well, I think that there are elements of the British government who are less woke than, you know, perhaps those people who are closest to the cabinet, etc. And it's what we can expect is that such people will have views in common with our own. You know, I think it's a mistake to think that the kind of views that we have are in any way strange or extreme. The views that we have and that British nationalists expound are common sense views, and views that are shared by the vast majority of the people in this country, certainly the vast majority of white people in this country. And and if there were free and fair elections in this country, and we were able to go about our business of winning over the hearts and minds of people, then I think that undoubtedly we would have a British nationalist government in fairly short order. It is only the constant denigration that that we come under from the mass media and from the wokerati and the political classes that keeps the majority of the public in a state of ignorance and perpetuates the current sort of malaise that we happen to be in.
I think he's correct as well. I think people have looked at these statues that are being attacked and they thought, well, I haven't heard that name before. I wonder what it was that he did. And I think there's a lot of support now for protecting them. There's the Save Our Statues campaign, and they've been having a lot of luck. Thousands of people are signing their petitions and saying, you know, we don't want to see the same thing happen to our statue that happened to Edward Colston. It's really sort of revitalized people's understanding of our past. And actually, our Greatest Briton that we've got today, I picked him because he's one of the statues that people have been trying to attack. And the really interesting thing about this guy was that this statue was actually built while he was still alive, which shows us just how well he was liked by the people. They actually got together and said, we want to build a statue of this man because he is such a great hero. And they knew him, they worked alongside him, and that's what that they thought so highly of him. They wanted to have this statue built. And when we look at these things that are happening, we do have to look at what the people were saying at the time. And if they wanted to put a statue up of somebody, it's because they were a fantastic person. And they are the witnesses of the time. The witnesses of the time say this was a very good man. So we can't then look back 150 years later and say we know better than the people did back then, because we're not time travellers. And the whole of history is built around going to primary sources, going to eyewitnesses, and you have to take what they say, because we're looking at it hundreds of years into the future, and they were looking at it at the time. So it's their views that count, not our views today. This whole idea of pulling down these statues goes against the very principles that historical inquiry is built upon. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max, or shall we get into our greatest Britons here now?
Well, I would just add one thing, which is that if you go into a court of law and you are asked to testify with regard to something, if you are just relying solely upon your memory, then a certain amount of credence is given to the things that you say. But if you can produce what are called contemporaneous notes, which are notes that you made at the very time that the event happened, and which are therefore a record that won't have been distorted over time. If you can produce contemporaneous notes and read those contemporaneous notes, they carry far more weight in law. And the point is that the views of people like Redvers Buller and Charles Gordon, the views of the public with regard to these people, and the views of their contemporaries, the people who lived and worked with them, are far more valuable as a testament to their real worth than are the views of people who are just looking back from the present day, because the views of the people who actually lived alongside these heroes of the past, their views are like the contemporaneous notes. These are words that were written about them. These are statues that were carved in honor of them, and they should carry far more weight than the views of modern day historians who like to be trendy and woke.
Well, they're the eyewitnesses, and of course eyewitnesses, it's what they say that counts in court. Well, let's get into our greatest Britons then. Our greatest Britons today is General Sir Redvers Henry Buller. General Sir Redvers Henry Buller of the Most Honourable Order of the Bath, the Most Distinguished Order of St. Michael and St. George, and a recipient of the Victoria Cross, was a British Army officer given the highest award for gallantry in the face of the enemy that can ever be awarded to British and Commonwealth forces. He served as Commander-in-Chief of the British forces in South Africa during the early months of the Second Boer War, and subsequently commanded the army in Natal Province during the Anglo-Zulu War. And as it says on his statue's plinth in Exeter, he saved Natal from the Zulus. And I think this is the first time that we've actually looked into the Zulu Wars. We've mentioned the Boer Wars before, I think, and the rather unfortunate concentration camp idea that was thought up with during that. And it was just a shame that we were fighting against other white people there, I think, with the Boer Wars. Yes. Do you want to add anything to this, Max?
I agree with the sentiments you've just expressed.
Well, let's get into his background then. Redvers Buller was born on the 7th of December 1839 at the family estate of Downs near Crediton in Devon, which had been inherited by his great-grandfather James Buller from his mother Elizabeth Gould, the wife of James Buller, who was an MP. And I looked up the name Gould because I thought, that might be a Jewish name. It sounds like gold. And apparently it's a very old British name, nothing Jewish about it at all. The Bullers were an old Cornish family, long being seated at Morval in Cornwall until they moved to Downs. The family estates, including Downs, inherited in 1874 by Redvers Buller from his unmarried elder brother James Howard Buller, included 2,942 acres in Devon and 2,174 acres in Cornwall, which in 1876 produced an income of £14,137 a year.
Wow.
Yeah, and the point of this is to say he didn't have to go out there into the army. He had an income. He was upper class. There was no need for him to actually go out there and fight in the forces. But that was the honourable thing to do. He couldn't just sit there and not work and just live on this income. And that was a huge income that he's got.
And the estate that he had in Devon and Cornwall didn't rely upon slave labour or anything like that at all. It didn't benefit from the cotton trade, didn't benefit from the slave trade, and it would have been an income generated off from the sweat of the brows of the people that worked for him on his land in Cornwall and Devon.
Really good point to make there, because as I say, they have been trying to pull his statue down. Apparently they say, oh, because he has a connection to empire, but everybody had a connection to empire in the 18th and 19th and early 20th century.
In the days of the empire, of course,
yeah,
we did.
Yeah, exactly. He was educated at Eton. Again, this shows he was very upper class. And after his education, he purchased a commission in the 60th Rifles in May of 1858. We've pointed out these commissions before, that this is how people would get started. Normally, they would fight in battles. And we pointed this out before, that people would join the Forlorn Hope and they would be paid for the risks that they took. And then with that money, they would use that to purchase a commission, and then they could work their way up through the military. And he began by purchasing this commission. So this tells us that even if you're upper class, you didn't just automatically get given a high-placed position within the army. He still had to purchase his commission. So he purchased his commission in the 60th Rifles in May of 1858. He served in the Second Opium War and was promoted captain before taking part in the Canadian Red River Expedition of 1870. In 1873 to 74, he was the intelligence officer under Lord Wolseley during the Ashanti Campaign, during which he was slightly wounded at the Battle of Ordubai. And we've heard of Lord Wolseley before. He was the one that went out to rescue Gordon from the Sudan. The Anglo-Ashanti Wars were a series of five 19th century conflicts that took place between 1824 and 1900 between the Ashanti Empire in the Akan interior of the Gold Coast and Great Britain and its allies. The British lost or negotiated truces in several of these wars, with the final war resulting in the British burning of the capital, Kumasi, and the official occupation of the Ashanti Empire in 1900. The wars were mainly due to Ashanti attempts to establish a stronghold over the coastal areas of present-day Ghana, which not only did the British not want, but also the Fanti and the Gar people, who were also used for human sacrifices by the Ashanti. With the final victory of the British, this barbaric practice was put an end to. Buller was promoted to Major and appointed a Companion of the Order of the Bath for his valour during this Third Ashanti War, which took place in 1873. So we see there that this wasn't just about trade, it was also about these barbaric practices that these savages had. They were savages. They were engaged in human sacrifice as well as slavery. They were sacrificing the people that were around them. And with the British winning the war, this human sacrifice was put an end to. And you were telling me, Max, that he was also rather like General Gordon. He was against slavery and did some things to help the people. Do you want to mention some of that or comment on this?
Well, from what I've read, it wasn't a matter of him actually doing something to combat slavery. It was just a matter that he was a person who was really liked by his men, because he always made sure they had the proper equipment. And this has got parallels really with Charles Gordon, where Charles Gordon always made sure that his men were properly equipped. And the fact that he fought in order to get the best equipment for his men meant that he was constantly in conflict with senior officers in the army and people in the Foreign Office and back at home politicians. And so whilst he was a very charismatic character, whilst he was a very good soldier and an excellent officer, he was courageous and daring and was awarded for that. He was, you know, caring for his men, and as a result of that, he was loved by his men, and in exactly the same way that Charles Gordon was.
I think that happened quite a lot with these people, that they were looking out for their men, and they would come to argue with the officers and with the politicians. And we can see later on in this story, actually, that they tried to make a scapegoat of Buller, which is why it's all the more remarkable that the public stayed behind him. And they wanted to put this statue up of him because they thought so highly of him, because the politicians really weren't too happy with him by the end of this story. But at this time, where he's in South Africa, we'll hear now about where he gets the Victoria Cross. Buller continued to serve in South Africa during the Ninth Cape Frontier War of 1878 and the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. In the Zulu War, he commanded the mounted infantry of the Northern British Column under Sir Evelyn Wood, where he fought at the British defeat of the Battle of Hlobane, where he was awarded the Victoria Cross for bravery under fire. His Victoria Cross citation reads, "For his gallant conduct at the retreat in Inhlobana on the 28th of March 1879, in having assisted, whilst hotly pursued by Zulus, in rescuing Captain C. D'Arcy of the Frontier Light Horse, who was retiring on foot, and carrying him on his horse until he overtook the rear guard. Also for having on the same date, and under the same circumstances, conveyed Lieutenant C. Everett of the Frontier Light Horse, whose horse had been killed under him, to a place of safety. Later on, Colonel Buller, in the same manner, saved a trooper of the Frontier Light Horse whose horse was completely exhausted and who otherwise would have been killed by the Zulus, who were within 80 yards of him." So three brave and courageous rescues there. This was actually a battle against the entire Zulu army in that area, numbering around 4,000 troops, and there was no chance of reinforcements arriving. In an interview with the Register newspaper of Adelaide, South Australia, dated 2nd of June 1917, Trooper George Ashby of the Frontier Light Horse gave an account of his rescue by Colonel Buller. He says, "It was discovered that the mountain was surrounded by a vast horde of Zulus. An attempt was made to descend on the side opposite to the pass. Corporal Ashby and his little party endeavoured to fight their way down, and at last he and a man named Andrew Gemmell, now living in New Zealand, were the only ones left. With their faces to the foe, firing as they retired, they kept the Zulus at bay. Then an unfortunate thing happened. Corporal Ashby's rifle burst, but fortunately for him, Colonel Buller, afterwards Sir Redvers Buller, who was one of the party, came galloping by and offered to take him up behind him. Colonel Buller was a heavy man and his horse was a light one, and realising this, Corporal Ashby declined his generous offer. But the colonel stayed with him, and Corporal Ashby, having picked up a rifle and ammunition from a fallen comrade, the two men retired, firing whenever a foeman showed himself. They eventually reached the main camp, and for this service, as well as for saving the lives of two fellow officers on the same occasion, Colonel Buller received the Victoria Cross. Out of 500 men who made the attack on the Hlobane Mountain, more than 300 met their death." So over half of them actually died at this point. And you were saying something, Max, about how he actually went back for them when he realised that they weren't with him or something.
Yes, I think that the main party of the British soldiers had escaped the Zulus, and it was then reported that these other groups had been left behind, and Buller then went back, and I wasn't quite sure whether he went back with a party of other men, but he listening to the accounts that you've just read there, it would appear that he went back single-handed with his horse to pick people up and then sort of carry them to safety, and it was for that bravery and the repeated going back to fight to collect more people that he was awarded the Victoria Cross, which, you know, it's a feature of management in large organisations, and I'm sure the army is exactly the same. That if you have an officer of a fairly modest rank, say captain or something of that sort, then they develop a strong affinity with the men that work under them, because one of the things you learn, particularly if you're in a very stressful situation such as warfare would create, when you're in that kind of a situation, loyalty is a two-way street. And if you are not loyal to your men, then you can't expect your men to be loyal to you. And this is something that people that are born into high office, etc., very often overlook, and they look down on people who are the working at the coal face, so to speak, people who are at the bottom of the social pyramid, and they regard those people as being expendable people, and therefore don't take as much care of them as they should do. But you know, people like Redvers Buller and Charles Gordon are men who became officers in the army, and who through their own skills at soldiery and own skills at leading other men worked their way up. But they never forgot that principle that loyalty is a two-way street, and that the very fact that these two men were held in such high esteem by the men that worked under them is a testament to that fact.
Yeah, the colonel went back for the corporals, basically. He went back for these lowest ranks, and he went back there on his own without a team. I mean, that's some bravery there. And it didn't stop there either, because the following day there was another battle. The following day, after the Battle of Hlobane, Buller fought in the British victory at the Battle of Kambula. And after the Zulu attacks on the British position were beaten off, he led a ruthless pursuit by the mounted troops of the fleeing Zulus. This time the battle was against the Impi, who were 21,000 men strong, consisting of regiments that had already defeated the British at the Battle of Isandlwana and elsewhere. Many of the Zulus were now armed with rifles that they had taken from the British dead at these battles, because up to this point the Zulus were fighting with shields and spears, but once they'd killed the British, of course they could steal the rifles. The Impi had not eaten for 3 days, which must have been a further encouragement for the British to ensure that they won this battle. At 1:30 p.m. Lieutenant Colonel Redvers Henry Buller and his men rode out to within range of the massed Zulus, fired a volley and raced back, closely followed by a great wave of 11,000 Zulu warriors shouting. As soon as the horsemen had reached Kambula and cleared the field of fire, the British infantry then opened fire with support from their 4 7-pounders, firing shells over the heads of the horsemen. And when the Zulus got closer, they engaged them with canister shot. A small number of Zulus managed to burst into the laager and were repelled with bayonets, while the bulk of the advance was held at bay by the steady British volley fire and artillery. Some of the Zulu force swung right to come in against the western side of the laager, but were met with equally effective volley fire. And at around 2:15 p.m, the Zulus on the right flank drew back to the northeast. So they're heavily outnumbered here, and the British have got their tactics. They want to draw these Zulus closer to them, and with their weaponry they can fire over the heads of the British and hit the Zulus that are chasing along behind them. I don't know if you want to comment on any of this, Max.
Well, I can't think of any useful comment to make, and apart from the fact that obviously these tactics appear to be very effective, and we have a relatively small contingent of British soldiers being able to take on and score heavily against a very large number of Zulus.
They had quite a lot of encouragement to defeat these Zulus as well, knowing that they hadn't eaten for 3 days. As the right horn made its withdrawal, the left horn and centre advanced towards a ravine below the redoubt and then attacked from the ravine at about 3 p.m. The leading warriors fell to volley fire from the 13th Light Infantry in the south face of the laager, and shrapnel and case shot from 4 British guns in the laager and 2 in the redoubt. More and more Zulu got into the ravine about 100 yards from the cattle kraal where the British were. About 40 Zulu riflemen climbed to the lip of the ravine, and 2 parties took over some huts to the east and a rubbish dump to the west, about 400 yards either side of the camp. The fire of the Zulu riflemen from the 3 positions forced most of the infantry in the cattle kraal to retreat into the redoubt and the rest to shelter behind wagons to the rear. Zulu morale arose at the sight of the British retreat, and the men in the ravine advanced on the cattle kraal, confronted only by fire from one side of the main laager, and soon forced their way into the kraal, fighting hand to hand with the men of the 13th Company. The cattle in the kraal hampered both sides, but with Zulu pressure mounting, most of the British troops managed to extricate themselves and pull back to the redoubt, with 4 killed and 7 wounded. Zulu riflemen were now able to open fire from behind the walls of the kraal to give covering fire for more Zulu that were advancing from the ravine. At about this time, the right horn came on again from the northeast, charging across the north face of the redoubt towards the guns and the eastern sides of the laager. Although attacked on both sides, Wood appreciated that to the south, 5,000 Zulu could shelter in the cattle kraal only 50 yards away, well within charging distance. Wood ordered two companies of the 90th Light Infantry to retake the cattle kraal with a bayonet charge. Led by Major Hackett, the men shifted a wagon from the northeast corner of the laager and formed a line with bayonets fixed. The British charged across the open ground and forced the Zulus back over the rim of the ravine. The troops then lined the crest and opened volley fire into the packed warriors. The counterattack had succeeded perfectly, but Hackett's men suddenly found themselves under fire from their right when Zulu marksmen in the huts and the rubbish dump on the left opened fire. Wood ordered the recall, Hackett sounded the retire, and his men returned to the cover of the laager, losing a colour sergeant and a subaltern, with Hackett receiving a blinding head wound. 44 men had been killed or wounded. The Royal Artillery fought with their guns in the open and poured round after round directly into the right horn and bombarded the huts with explosive shell and shrapnel to suppress the Zulu riflemen. The rubbish dump, which was on the other side of the laager, was also then struck by volley fire, which stopped the Zulu from replying. The Zulus charged again and again with unwavering courage, but the head of each charge was just shot away. More Zulus tried massing in the ravine, but before their attack could get going, two companies of the 13th Light Infantry ran to the edge of the ravine and mowed down the Zulus below. At about 5:30 p.m., the tired Zulu survivors began to retire, with Buller in hot pursuit with his 600 horse. The Zulu continued to jog trot as the horsemen in three columns closed up and attacked, harrying them mercilessly, with mounted troops firing one-handed with carbines from the saddle, before using their carbines again as clubs and then spearing them through with their discarded spears. Another tribe, the Abukaluzi, then arrived and began running with the rest of the Zulu force. Captain Cecil Darcy of the Frontier Light Horse ordered his troopers to take no prisoners, telling them, "No quarter, boys, and remember yesterday," referring to the action at Clobane where his men had suffered severely. The FLH singled out the Abukaluzi, chasing them as far as Clobane, and extracted a savage revenge for their comrades killed the day before, with Darcy recalling that they butchered the brutes all over the place, while Buller was like a tiger drunk with blood. Following the cavalry, the British infantry combed the field, killing any wounded or hiding Zulus left, and at around 6:30 p.m. as dusk fell, a mist arose around the Zunguin Mountains, stopping the pursuit. Kambula was the decisive battle of the war. In 4 hours, the British had fired 138,000 rounds and 1,077 shells, demonstrating that shield and spear were no match for an entrenched force with artillery and the Martini Henry rifle. Never again would an Impi fight against a prepared position with the ferocity and resolution displayed at Kambula. And despite the Zulu commander trying to get his regiments to return to the capital of Ulundi for a final battle, most simply went home and resumed raiding. The shock of the defeat contributed to a weakening of the Zulu resolve to maintain armed resistance to the British invasion, and Commander Schoenbrugger summed the battle up by saying that they succumbed to superior weapons and the murderous fire of big guns, but they died like brave men and good soldiers in defence of their chief country. We buried the Zulu dead with full military honours. So they didn't mistreat the dead. They knew that they had been fighting against courageous soldiers here. And I mean, very lucky that he actually rescued this Darcy the day before, because he was obviously played an important role in this battle here. Have you got any comments you want to make on this, Max?
Well, just that that account is a very vivid account of what was obviously a tremendous battle and a very, as you say, a very decisive battle in the Zulu Wars. And we've had quite some time ago now. I mean, I wonder when the film Zulu was actually made. The film Zulu was probably made well, I don't know, I wouldn't like to guess, but it's several decades ago, and nothing like it's ever been produced since. But it would seem that this particular battle might be a suitable subject for another film in a similar vein, and that would be a sight to behold, wouldn't it?
Well, we need to remember the, you know, the bravery and everything that went on in these battles. And I find it, where it's so detailed, there must have been a big debriefing afterwards, so they must have written it all down, exactly what happened, so that we had it for posterity. And, you know, there's lots of this stuff that's out there on the internet. You know, you can research what happened in our past and think this is the sort of thing that young men would get involved in 150 years ago. And what are they doing now? They're just playing computer games. You know, when we had the British Empire.
While people may say that these wars were only won because of the superior technology that our army had, from the account that you've just read out, we're talking about hundreds of British soldiers fighting against thousands, tens of thousands of Zulus. And so it is, each one of these battles was a battle between a small contingent, a relatively small contingent of people who were armed with what would have been cutting edge technology in military terms in those days, against a massively greater force of Zulus, who would have been armed with their spears and shields, but many of whom would also have been armed with rifles as well.
And also, you know, there was no killing of the civilians then. This was protecting the civilians, and the point of a battle is to win the battle, isn't it? If you've got superior firepower, you don't hold back and say, well, we won't use our superior firepower, we'll just use bayonets and make it evens because you've only got spears and shields. You know, the point of this is to win the battle and put a stop to the Zulus and put a stop to their human sacrifice, which was a benefit for all of these tribes around. Well, in June 1879, Buller again commanded the mounted troops at the Battle of Ulundi, where the British Army finally broke the military power of the Zulus by defeating the main Zulu army and immediately afterwards capturing and razing the capital of Zululand, the Royal Kraal of Ulundi. British casualties were 10 killed and 87 wounded, while nearly 500 Zulu dead were counted, with another 1,000 or more being wounded. Chelmsford ordered the Royal Kraal of Ulundi to be burnt and the capital of Zululand burned for days, and Wolseley swiftly divided up Zululand into 13 districts, installing compliant chiefs in each one so that the kingdom could no longer unite under one ruler. And that's similar to what we see going on today, isn't it? Let's import lots and lots of diversity so that the British people can't unite against the despots and the regime. It's such an old trick, isn't it? Just split everybody up so they can't unite. Well, Buller went through one promotion after another following this, and he took part in the expedition to relieve General Gordon under Lord Wolseley. He was expected to be made Commander-in-Chief of the British Army in 1895, but this did not happen because the government was replaced and Lord Wolseley was appointed instead, with Buller being promoted to full general. And I'm thinking this must have been what happened after Gordon, because you remember the government fell, didn't it? So the government that was in place at the time, that would have been the one that was going to promote Buller. And because of the new government that came in, they promoted Wolseley instead. Do you want to make any comments on this, Max?
No, I've got no further sort of insights into that. As you've read it all appears to make sense to me, and I can't think of anything else that I could usefully add at this point.
Well, Buller was popular as a military leader among the public in England, and he had a triumphal return from South Africa with many public celebrations, including those on the 10th of November 1900, when he went to Aldershot to resume his role as General Officer commanding Aldershot District, which was later to be remembered as, quote, a Buller Day. So he actually gave his name to some kind of celebration. He spent the following months giving lectures and speeches on the Boer War and was promoted to a Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George in November 1900 and received the Honorary Freedom of the Borough of Plymouth in April 1901. When he fought in the Boer War against other whites, however, he did not do so well and was made a scapegoat by the press, who made numerous attacks on the performance of the British Army in South Africa. The matter came to a head when a virulent piece written by the Times journalist Leo Amery was publicly answered by Buller in a speech on the 10th of October 1901. Minister for War John Broderick saw his opportunity to pounce, and summoning Buller to an interview on the 17th of October, Broderick, with Lord Roberts in support, demanded his resignation on the grounds of breaching military discipline. Buller refused and was summarily dismissed on half pay on the 22nd of October, with his request for a court-martial being refused, as was his request to appeal to the king. So the mainstream media have really advanced quickly. I mean, they were the ones that were responsible for the British going out there into the Sudan, because they wanted this war against the crazy Mahdi and his Islamic State, and they manipulated Gordon in that interview into suggesting that that was what needed to be done. And here we see just a few years later that they're also manipulating the war out in South Africa. You know, this Times journalist is, and these this Broderick and Lord Roberts, they're obviously working with the media by this time. And it was the other way around with Gordon. I don't know if you've got any comments. Well,
an interesting anecdote here is that Lord Roberts' son had served under Buller in South Africa, and he'd been killed in a battle, and Lord Roberts held Buller responsible for his son's death.
Right. So,
and also another feature here is that Buller was making a request, was requesting an appeal to the king, and what we've not sort of noted is that Queen Victoria has died and her son has taken over, and it was well known at the time that the king, can't think what his name was, had a distinct dislike for Buller as well. Probably as a result of his advisers wrongly reporting things that Buller had done, and perhaps upon the reports of Lord Roberts.
So he really upset the top brass by sticking up for the little guy, for sticking up for the lower ranks. And that is obviously what he was doing, because the public was so supportive of him. Despite this, there were many public expressions of sympathy for Buller, especially in the West Country, where in 1905, by public subscription, a notable statue of Buller astride his war horse was erected in Exeter on the road from his hometown of Crediton, facing away from Crediton to the annoyance of its inhabitants. He married but did not have any children, and died on the 2nd of June 1908 at the family seat, Downs House, Crediton, Devon, where he is buried in the churchyard of Holy Cross Church. The entire western side of the chancel arch inside the church forms an elaborate monument to Sir Redvers. In England, Canada and Trinidad, there are roads named after him. There is a recumbent effigy of him in Winchester Cathedral, bearing the words, "A great leader, beloved of his men." And a bronze equestrian statue of him is situated in Exeter at the junction of New North Road and Heal Road near St David's Church on the route between the city and Buller's home at Downs, Crediton. And it's interesting that they're trying to pull this statue down. They're attacking Buller when it was the lower classes that were the ones that really wanted this statue of him to be put there, because he'd been standing up for them so much.
Yeah, I mean, Buller, just as Gordon was a man of the people. And, you know, I can remember when we were talking about Charles Gordon, just marvelling, really, at the things that he'd done, the corrupting corruptingly lucrative offers that were made to him that he turned down because he felt that was wrong. And the fact that he always fought to make sure that his men had the proper the equipment, etc., in exactly the same way that Buller did. And it's a common feature that runs through large sort of organisations and corporations, as I said earlier on, that you get certain people who are good soldiers, and because they're good soldiers, they make good officers, and that then brings them into conflict with people higher up who are political appointees, effectively, very often, and who have got a dislike and a And who disparage the common people, and who disparage the squaddies that have been recruited and that fill the lower ranks, and that always brings them then into conflict with people like Buller, who always fight for their men.
And it must have been a proper grassroots support that he had, because it wasn't just the top brass that were against him. The media were against him. The journalists were against him. So it was the public that supported him and wanted this statue to be made. That we didn't have non-governmental organisations back then organising things. I mean, when they talk about public support for something today, it means that the media have decided there should be public support for it. Or it means that there's some advocacy group that are advocating for it. And that wasn't the case here. It was the people of Crediton, it was the people of Exeter that said, we want this statue to be made of this man. This is a great man. This is a great hero. We want future generations to remember him in a very, very positive light, such a positive light that we got this statue made of him while he was still alive. It's absolutely disgraceful that there are calls to now pull this statue down by people that are newcomers to the country. They're not, they're not the descendants of the people that put this statue up in the first place. It's shocking that that's going on, and I'm very pleased that we went into his life story today, and that we will honour him as one of Radio Albion's greatest Britons.
Yeah, I mean, one last thing before we finish is we mentioned about the Ashanti and the Ashanti occupying the land, the sort of hinterland beyond the Gold Coast, which is precisely the areas where Negro slaves were captured from rival tribes and then taken down to the Gold Coast to be sold to the European slavers, who then took them off to America. And so, Buller actually fought against the people who were doing the slaving.
He fought against the people doing the slaving, and he stopped the human sacrifice, and he was well loved by his people. A great man. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.